resolving the Palestine-Zionist conflict and the wider Arab-Israeli conflict is probably the single most important thing that could be done to bring about a peaceful, stable, productive, and joyful Middle East.
That's Rami Khoury, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamyan. This edition of AR features Rami Khoury on war or peace in the Middle East. The ceasefire between Israel and the Palestinians is in its first phase. Some captives have been released, with more to follow. Aid trucks are delivering desperately needed food, water, and medicine to the besieged Palestinians. What the future will bring is uncertain. The situation is fragile. What is certain is the Palestinians have endured disproportionate death and destruction. Israel has a powerful military and the backing of the United States. The BBC says, after 15 months of war in Gaza, the conflict is as bitter and intractable as ever. The consequences of so much destruction and death will be felt for a generation at least. The long overdue ceasefire may stop the killing, but won't end the conflict. Our guest today is Rami Khoury, a veteran journalist who has reported on the Middle East for decades. He was executive editor of the Beirut Daily Star, and before that, editor-in-chief of the Jordan Times. He was the founding director of the Issam Faris Institute for Public Policy and International Affairs at the American University of Beirut. He's co-author of Understanding Hamas and Why That Matters. I talked with Rami Khoury in mid-January. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
The Middle East region is in turmoil. For decades, it has been devastated by wars, coups, assassinations, invasions, and occupations. I'm wondering about cultural attitudes informing political perspectives of the West. How are Arabs, Iranians, Turks, and other Muslims seen through the prism of what Edward Said wrote about in his classic book, Orientalism? Clichés and cultural stereotypes within a colonial context and imperial political framework. How about all that historical baggage that goes into factoring issues?
You know, all of that is active today and even more obvious and visible than it has been for many, many years, even decades, because of the American-funded, British-assisted, German-enabled Israeli genocide in Gaza. We've had the worst level of human atrocity anywhere in the world, I believe, in the last maybe half a century. So there's been a couple of bad things in Africa, but not the systematic physical and human destruction and perpetual pain inflicted on innocent civilians living in tents, including starvation and burning them and killing them and destroying all their schools and hospitals. We haven't seen that level of cruelty and destruction and savagery, and the West has pretty much gone along with it, with a few exceptions only. And this is the most glaring evidence of what is the real relationship between people in the West, or God, let's say governments, to be fair, because people are more reasonable. Governments in the West, most governments, with only a few exceptions, and the people and movements, political, cultural, social resistance, all the different movements across the Middle East, not just the Arab world and Palestine, but also Turkey and Iran and other places. And, you know, the ceasefire negotiations, which have been going on and off for months, they've already also clarified for the Western world. And you see this in the news media. I mean, I was watching the Western media carefully from my home in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and listening to the two American presidents, Trump and Biden, talking about it. Every sentence they said should be a footnote in a new edition of Said's Orientalism book, because they essentially talked about the Israeli families who have hostages in Gaza, and they either didn't mention the Palestinians at all, or just perfunctorily mentioned saying, well, the humanitarian aid should increase. And clearly the message is, Israel is what counts. Not all Jews support what Israel is doing. In fact, probably a majority of Western Jews are opposed to what Israel is doing. But for American and British and German and other politicians, this is all that matters. And this is a continuation of not just the last 75 years of the Arab-Israeli-Palestine-Israel conflict, but really the last three centuries or so, since Napoleon started attacking Lebanon and Egypt in 1798. We've had nonstop Western military, not just involvement, but physical attacks, military attacks and occupations and colonization and colonialism, culminating in the last major Western imperial colonial movement, which was Zionism, which was supported by very few Jews when it started in the late 19th century. But then the British, being the godmother of all colonialists and savages in the region, supported this process to create a Jewish home, Palestine, where 93% of the land was and the population was Palestinian Arab, including my family in Nazareth. So this is a long process. This is a lingering historical phenomenon of Western governments mainly, and many people, but not all, but the governments mainly looking at the Arabs as inconsequential or even non-existent people, and looking at the Palestinians particularly as totally invisible and even dangerous people who need to be eradicated. And this is what the Israelis have now done in this last phase in the Gaza genocide. It's really astounding to see all of this happening, not just what the Israelis are doing. That's not a surprise, because Zionism from its conception was aimed to drive out the Palestinians, as many as possible, keeping in mind the Palestinians were 93% of the population in 1910 or so, to drive them out, but also to kill as many as possible, and then to create a Jewish state that dominates not just Palestine, but the region. And we see this, and I say dominates, it doesn't mean that it occupies the region, but what the Israelis are doing now and what they've done in the last couple of years, they attack Syria, they attack Lebanon, they attack Iraq, they attack Iran, they attack Yemen. Anybody in the region, doesn't matter if they're Christian, Muslim, whatever nationality, organized groups, civilian supporters, whatever they are, the Israelis with their massive Western-provided and funded military might have the right, in their views, to attack anybody in the entire region, destroy their societies as they've done in Gaza and South Lebanon, destroy their military capabilities as they've just done in Syria. And this is the wider threat that Zionism poses to the region. And that's why so many ordinary people around the Arab world in the Middle East, Arabs and non-Arabs, support the Palestinians, and why so many people around the Global South support the Palestinians. And one of the striking consequences of the last year and 4 months has been the massive international popular support, and many governments around the South, to support the Palestinians in their struggle to achieve their rights, not to destroy Israel, but to achieve their rights as Palestinians living in a Palestinian state alongside Israel, enjoying absolutely and simultaneously equal rights with the Israelis, not secondary residual half rights as servants and day laborers, and like the African Black Africans did in South Africa for many years until they achieved their liberation as well. So you've got all of these dynamics and many, many others happening at the same time. The most terrible one, in my view, in the Western world, and the United States is the leader in this, is the Zionist manipulated and supported dynamic that tries to not just silence Palestinians or voices that speak for Palestinian justice, but to criminalize expressing support for Palestine and to criminalize being a Palestinian. So if you walk around with a Palestine pin or a keffiyeh around your neck, which that is now in many parts of the U.S., a crime. And it's become a crime because nincompoop lawmakers in the United States who have no concept of what's really happening in the region and what's happened in the last century, they just go and do whatever Israel and AIPAC ask them to do. And this is why you end up with laws that make it a crime to boycott Israel because of its apartheid actions and genocidal actions, reaching a stage where it's a crime in some American states and cities to teach a course on Palestine at a university or to hold a conference. So this is the secondary line of damage that Zionism is doing, besides what it's doing in the region, in Palestine and Lebanon and other places. It's also eroding the foundations and the core principles of Western democratic, pluralistic, constitutional, republican, small r values, free speech, equal rights, access to the law, etc., etc. And these are being slowly eroded, along with the vicious Israeli-American-led attempt against the International Criminal Court and the International Court of Justice. So what you're seeing is that the Zionist movement, perpetuated by the state of Israel now, the government of Israel, is slowly degrading and destroying the values of global coexistence and human rights guarantees for all people that emerged after World War II because of the genocide against the Jews in Nazi Germany. But that period is over, and the Israelis are the ones who are leading the assault on those principles, and most of the Western world is doing nothing about it or going along with it quietly. So this is a real, real dangerous but historic moment. But in the face of this, you have almost the entire global South and probably half of the global North supporting the Palestinians, opposing what the Israelis are doing, taking Israelis to court for their genocidal actions and other things. And in the United States, you see, for instance, the student movement, which is led by American Jews in many, many parts of it. And you have this tremendous global support for this peaceful protest against what Israel and its Western supporters are doing. So we're in a new battle now that has come out of the Arab-Israeli or Palestinian Zionist conflict. And this is a new phase now where the battle lines are in the media, in education, and in the law. And this is really a fascinating and important phenomenon because it's in those areas precisely where Zionists don't have the advantages they used to always have in the legislatures and presidential offices in the Western world. You know, the Zionist lobbying effort, which succeeded amazingly to create a Jewish state and a 93% Arab land. A spectacular book by Israeli historian Ilan Pappe has just documented the whole history of Zionist lobbying in the West, mainly in Great Britain and then in the United States. And it focuses heavily, almost exclusively, on the levers of power in the executive branch and in the congressional, parliamentary, or legislative branch. That's all they really care about, the people who make power. They don't care if people in Madison, Wisconsin, or Boulder, Colorado, or Syracuse, New York, where I went to school, they don't really care if people there start criticizing them and analyzing them and pointing out their criminal activities, because that doesn't influence the policies. And we saw that now, that in the genocide in Gaza, it's the political decision makers in Washington and in London who made the decisions to totally support the Israelis. And that's what they care about. But that is starting to also fray at the edges. So in the U.S. Congress now, you know, you can probably expect 100 senators and congressmen and women to support a reasonable motion to criticize Israel, curtail its human rights and other violations, and deny it American support so that it can't keep doing a genocide while American laws are being challenged and broken, because American law says you can't provide foreign aid to people carrying out atrocities and human rights denials and pogroms. So this is fascinating now to see how over time, you see it in public opinion, clearly 70% of Americans roughly are wanted ceasefire, and they maybe 55, 60 want limits on American military supplies to Israel. These are huge historical changes among the people. You don't have that level of criticism of Israel in the official systems of government, but it's slowly happening in the Congress and even in the executive branch. You have, probably had a dozen or so officials in the U.S. resign because they couldn't keep behaving the way that their government was telling them to behave. And therefore, the changes that are happening slowly but steadily. And more importantly, they're being led in many cases by young American Jews, progressive Jews, and they're spreading all over the world. And this is a slow process. It takes time to mobilize people to be able to pressure officials to change policies. So that's a long answer to your short question, but there's so many things happening at the same time that it's important to try to, I think, understand them in that complete context.
The Israeli response, almost automatic, to these criticisms of what they're doing, what their policies are in the Arab Middle East and specifically in Palestine, is that it's all self-defense. We're surrounded by enemies who wish us harm, and any state would have to protect its citizens. That's their line. Put yourself in their shoes for a second and sort that out.
This is a line that has emerged really since the Holocaust and the creation of the State of Israel. Before that, when Zionism started in the late 19th century, very few Jews supported it, but enough of them did, and they were good enough at lobbying British officials initially to make progress and create a Jewish state in Arab Palestine. And this is important to note that their argument there was that the Jews needed a safe haven from European pogroms and anti-Semitism and massacres, which probably makes sense. But you can't give them a state by stealing the land of other people, which is what the British did in Palestine. But after 1948, you had conflicts, structural, ongoing conflicts between Israel and many Arab states, and then the Palestine resistance movement as it started to grow and develop, starting in the late 1960s, and now has developed in other ways in tandem with Hezbollah in Lebanon and the Ansarullah in Yemen and support from Iran and other places. So there's a wider ring of resistance and opposition to Israel. And it's not just opposition to Israel, the axis of resistance. They're opposing what Israel's doing, but they're also opposing what Western hegemony is trying to do. So it's clearly packaged in the context of opposing Western colonial domination and aggression, which is manifested most dramatically in the Middle East by what the Israelis are doing. And this Israeli argument that the Israelis have the right to defend themselves on paper is correct. Every state has a right to defend itself. But there's two issues that the Israelis ignore, that there are laws that were created after World War II, the rules of law and humanitarian law and all kinds of crimes of war and stuff. These laws were designed to protect innocent people because of the way the Jews were mistreated by the Nazis, and to make sure that this never happens again. The other point is that just as Israel has a right to defend itself, so do Palestinians under occupation, so do Lebanese, so do every. So look at all the people that Israel has attacked in the region, and they all have a right to defend themselves too. So this Israeli double standard, or the Zionist, let's call, because not all Israelis support this, but the Zionist double standard of Israel having the absolute, pervasive, and eternal right to use any force it wants to attack any group or person or country it wants in the region or further afield by assassinating, you know, people in other countries, that this logic of Israel has reached an extreme now that it is starting to generate criticisms around the world. And slowly, you're getting situations where legal efforts are taking place in Europe and North America and other places, making it difficult for some Israeli soldiers and officials to travel. They're afraid to travel because they're going to get arrested and sent to the International Criminal Court. So the idea that Israel has a right to protect itself is true in principle, but in practice, it is used as a vehicle to assure perpetual racist apartheid savagery that has now reached the level of plausible genocide, according to the International Court of Justice. And this is the dilemma that Israel has faced. It's kind of ironic that at the 100th anniversary of the League of Nations mandate that came into force in Palestine, whereby the British got the League of Nations to create a mandate for the British to run Palestine. And in the mandate was embedded the Balfour Declaration of 1917, which said that Britain will help pave the way to create a Jewish state or a Jewish homeland. And that was in 1924. And here we are just after 2024, 100 years later, we've seen the consequences of this. It took a long time for the Israelis to reach a level of savagery and aggression against people all over the region and domination over Western constitutional systems of governance, whereby the Israelis, through their very astute and aggressive lobbying, which includes enticements and threats and other things, where they could get people like Joe Biden and Kamala Harris to join the savagery and to celebrate the savagery, to say that, you know, they will always support Israel, whatever it does. And this is why Kamala Harris, in her incompetence and lack of humanity, lost, because she was seen to be, by Americans, not just Arabs and Muslims, but by many Americans, she was seen to be part of the genocide. So again, that argument of we have a right to defend ourselves is good for public relations when you're appealing to people who don't know anything about the region, whether, you know, in different parts of Europe or the US or in rural communities or in small towns, or where people just don't follow these issues. They don't know the facts. And therefore, it sounds great to say this. They say, oh, yeah, of course you have a right to defend yourself. But then the critical point to keep your eye on is the officials in, you know, Colorado and San Francisco and Kansas and Pennsylvania, all over these officials who represent their American constituents in Congress, how are they voting and who are they getting money from to run their campaigns? And if they criticize Israel, who is opposing them to drive them out of Congress? And this is the dynamic that now has reached a serious new peak. And we saw several Congress people lose their seats in primaries because through AIPAC, the big Israeli lobby in the U.S., the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, the Israelis attacked electorally and financially two or three people like Cori Bush and others, and they lost. This happened before. You go back to Paul Finley and Pete McCloskey and Chuck Percy. There's other people 20, 30, 40 years ago in Congress who similarly, when they dared to speak out, even mildly asking for Israel to stop killing Palestinians or whatever, or occupying land, the lobby turned against them and they got voted out. So the American top level of the political system, the Congress and the executive in Washington, have been conditioned by lobbying, by the Zionist groups and the state of Israel, to not challenge Israel. But it's not working because, like I said, you could probably get 100 members of Congress now who in the Senate and the House who would oppose Israel, who would vote against it. And this is increasing. Every time Israel does something terrible, it increases. And it's increasing because ordinary Americans have seen the truths of what Israel and Zionism are doing, and they don't want to support that. They don't want to be a part of it. So we're these incremental changes at the local community level across the United States and in many parts of Europe are really the critical driving force of the political evolution of Western support for the state of Israel. There's still ironclad support for a secure Jewish majority state of Israel, but there's also increasing demands at all levels of government and society that the Palestinians also must have their state with equal rights to the Israelis, not subsidiary or secondary rights. If they behave, they get more land or something. That was tried in the past in Camp David and Oslo, and it doesn't work. The trend in the United States and many parts of Europe is to demand equal rights for Israelis and Palestinians, but political leaders or politicians, let's call them, are afraid to speak out too boldly on this because they'll lose their seats. And they've seen this happen. Every time there is a national election in the US, the Israeli pro-Israel lobby targets some people, has a lot of money, and causes some people to lose their office. This is the new battlefield in electoral politics and in the legal systems in the US, the court challenges to make sure that basic fundamental principles of American constitutionalism, freedom of speech, equality before the law, due process of law, that these fundamentals are safeguarded and not whittled away by pro-Israeli policies. Now, these fundamentals may be whittled away by American officials in the new government coming into power in the US. That's a separate question. If a majority of Americans supports a candidate like Trump and says, we don't need equal speech, equal rights, or free speech, or we should limit what some people say. Well, that if the US decides that on the basis of domestic American issues, nothing to do with Israel or foreign policy, that's a separate question. That becomes a more serious challenge to the American people. I'm talking about the dangers that are already being implemented because of the very severe and sophisticated and effective pro-Israel Zionist lobbying efforts that are happening. These are all now challenged openly, that you can find web there, you can follow people on Twitter and Facebook and I don't know what, that show you who AIPAC is giving money to. I think it's called AIPAC Tracker. And you see this candidate in Kansas or Illinois or wherever has received 250,000 or 700,000 or 1.5 million from AIPAC over the last few years. So this is all coming out into the public now, which is another novelty. This never happened in the past. And really, it's only in the last, I would say, 10, 15 years that we've seen this kind of public sharing of knowledge about precisely what the Zionist lobby is doing, the Israeli lobby, and why it's wrong, and what people should do to counter it. And there's an incredible amount of work happening now around the United States at community level, through churches, through political groups, through progressive groups, intercommunal group, Blacks, Hispanics, Jews, women's groups, students, labor unions. I mean, this is super important. And people are studying this now to understand how do we keep this going? How do we maintain the fundamental goodness of American society, which has been whittled away by the combination of internal dominance of extreme capitalist and often racist and anti-Semitic forces. So this is an unbelievably important historical juncture. And there's about 8 or 10 different serious things happening in different domains. And it's a little bit overwhelming to try to capture them all, but I think slowly people are doing this, are realizing the connections among all of these different domains, the way effectively that activists and ordinary citizens can behave if they want to oppose the Israeli genocide and the Americans who support the Israeli genocide. use their electoral power, use the power of the press and the ability to organize, and the institutions of society, labor unions, church groups, local clubs, student groups. There's all kinds of institutions in the US, local, state, and national, that are re-emerging and re-finding, rediscovering the power they have, which they first discovered, I believe, at least in my lifetime, in the anti-Vietnam War movement in the late 60s, early 70s. I lived through that as a college student, and it was very slow in the beginning. And this is what's important for everybody who's interested in this to understand. We're not going to get dramatic victories tomorrow, but the trend is in the direction of more justice for all involved. And one day, hopefully, it will result in Israelis and Palestinians living in their peaceful states without apartheid, without a genocide, without racism, and without barbaric policies supported by Western governments.
You're listening to Rami Khoury, War or Peace in the Middle East. This is Independent Alternative Radio. For copies of this program, call us 1-800-444-1977 or go online our website, alternativeradio.org. 20% of Israel's population is Arab-Palestinian. What is their situation like? I believe they have representatives in the Knesset, the Israeli parliament. Is that correct?
They do, and this includes my family in Nazareth and other parts of Israel who never left, Christian Palestinians. They have the ability to form political parties. They tended initially to gravitate to the communists and the leftists. And then slowly you had some Arab and Palestinians who are Israeli citizens working closely with Jewish Israelis from Jewish Israeli political parties working together. These tended to be leftist groups, but they've always been structured in a way that they would not have any serious impact, that they would always remain a minority. They can get maybe 5-8% of the vote in the Knesset. So they haven't been able to generate the kind of impact that people would want them to have. So they focus more on trying to lobby for reducing the structural official discrimination and racism that has defined Israel since its birth and in 48. For instance, making sure that social security benefits, electricity expansion, schooling opportunities, all of these fundamental issues of life can be applied equally to Arab and Jewish Israelis. And that's where they tend to focus their efforts. And they've made a lot of progress, but Israel is still officially a society for the Jewish people. The Arabs who are citizens of the state of Israel do not have totally equal rights for various reasons. The main one being that Zionism was designed to create a state for the Jews, not a state for everybody who lived in Palestine. They wanted the Jewish, they tried to get a Jewish, pure Jewish state by driving the Palestinians out in 47, 48, and even before that. But it proved impossible. And the tenacious manner in which Palestinians have continued to resist this century, if even more than a century, it started in the late 1890s, but over a century, almost a century and a quarter of Zionist attempts to Judaize Palestine and de-Arabize it, de-Palestinize it. The struggle to stay there and fight for our rights politically, economically, morally, and militarily. This has been one of the most heroic, dramatic, moving episodes of modern national movements, which, of course, the Western media has never recognized in the same way they recognize the, for instance, and rightly so, the Jewish struggle to oppose fascism in Europe and things like that. And you see it again, the media has been a critical element for the Zionist propaganda to achieve its goals. And you see the glorification in the media of Israel, but more than the glorification, you see the humanization. So if you just watch TV now, whatever stage we are in the ceasefire and the prisoner exchanges and the hostage exchanges, you see it every day. It's really disgraceful for American media ethics that it's heavily, heavily tilted, like 85-90%, to stress the Israelis' rights, the Israeli gains, the Israeli fears and torment and pain and the joy of having hostages released, all of which is fair enough. The media should do that. But you see almost nothing comparable to talk about the Palestinian side, except these very vague generalizations that politicians make about the Palestinian suffering must be reduced and humanitarian aid must be surged. They like to use military terms because the U.S. is fundamentally abroad, is a military actor more than anything else. So they talk about surging this and doing that. So the really hard reality that the Israelis, Jews around the world, and Zionists and their supporters have to come to grips with is that in this last 100 or more years of the conflict between Zionism and Palestinian Arabism, Zionists have triumphed by creating a state, a very powerful state. And the Palestinians are almost helpless, but not totally helpless. And the Palestinians have resisted steadfastly in every possible way they can, and they continue to resist. And when the ceasefire happens in Gaza, which it will at some point, this is going to be a significant statement of the triumph of Palestinian resistance and national steadfastness and commitment to Palestinian people's rights in their homeland. And how those then enter into a political negotiation with the state of Israel to achieve an Israeli state and a Palestinian state living side by side, that's for the future to determine. We don't know how that's going to happen now. But the simple fact that the Palestinians continue to fight, continue to resist, refuse to be driven off their land. The Israelis tried everything they could in Gaza in the last 15 months or so to make the place physically inhabitable. No water, no agriculture, no hospitals, no schools, no electricity. It's incredible. No fuel, no medicine. They've tried every trick in the devil's book to drive the Palestinians out, force them out. Go to Sinai, go to Libya, go to Saudi Arabia. There's lots of room in northern Saudi Arabia. And the Palestinians would not go, except a few families that desperately needed to get medical care for their kids or something. And the Arabs, to their credit, refused to go along with this. And the Americans were trying to be involved. But this Israeli attempt to physically push the Palestinians out of Gaza did not succeed. And Hamas, amazingly, kept resisting. And you can criticize Hamas all you want, but if you only criticize Hamas and you don't mention what the Israelis are doing, you're an inconsequential, heartless, ethically empty liar. Nobody will believe you. But this is what happens among Western politicians. They focus on the rights of the Israelis, the pain of the Jews, and the Palestinians are always mentioned passively as some people suffering or the suffering needs to be improved. So all of these traditions, these patterns of the consequences of racism, apartheid, colonialism, predatory nationalistic Zionist religious fanaticism, all of these things have peaked now, and maybe they'll get worse. I don't think so. I think we've reached a moment where the Israelis have gone too far in their strategy, and the worst aspect of this was the combination of what they did in Lebanon and in Gaza and wiping out the whole Syrian defense system when the new government took over in Syria. So the Zionist extremist movement, which achieved the Jewish state in 48, remarkably, has never tried to find a way to protect that state by reaching agreements with the Palestinians and Arab neighbors and others who've all offered to coexist with the Jewish majority state of Israel as long as the Palestinians get the rights. They've never done it. They've played along, they've tricked us, they've come up with all kinds of diversionary tactics, and they're still doing it. But the reality is that what we have to achieve now, we meaning the people in the Middle East, but the whole world, is the single most important element, in my view, of a peaceful, rational, decent Middle East, which is to define Zionism. It's never been defined geographically, politically, demographically, or militarily. So what are the rights of Zionists? What does a Zionist state mean? Does it have the total right to do any military damage it wants around the region? If somebody in Pakistan seems to be planning to challenge the Israelis, are they going to go and kill them in Pakistan? Well, they've done that before in Iran and other places around the world. And so the danger now is that Israel's bloodbath that it is causing across the region will be allowed to continue. And with the same justification that Israel has a right to protect itself. But what we've seen is that this argument is losing power, losing support, and the steadfast resistance of the Palestinians is generating a lot of support. But the important thing there is that the Palestinian resistance, Hamas in particular, has repeatedly expressed, officially in the media, in private letters to George Bush, to the Israeli Prime Minister, and to others, the Hamas has repeatedly expressed a willingness to coexist peacefully with Israel if basic Palestinian demands are met. And these demands are enshrined in UN resolutions. They're not just extreme Hamas demands. But the Israelis never respond. The Americans never respond. The Arab peace plan had all the Arab 22 states and another, I think, 57 Islamic majority states supporting the Arab peace plan of 2002, which said to the Israelis, we will live in peace with you if you withdraw from the 67 occupied lands and allow a Palestinian state to happen and find a resolution to the refugee issue that satisfies both sides. So nothing would be forced on the Israelis. Everything would be negotiated. But the Israelis never responded. The Americans never responded. And that's why people see what's happening now and they go back to the idea that you mentioned before in Edward Said's Orientalist, that the imperial colonial Western dynamic combined with the Zionist dynamic has created a monster of predatory bloodbaths and geographical expansion stomping on the lives and rights of anybody in the region who dares to challenge Israel or Zionism. And so this is an awful position to be in if you're an Israeli. I mean, I know from experience, many Jews around the world are perturbed by this. They're bothered by it. They're not sure how to respond to it. But it's up to the Israelis in the first instance to do this, to define Zionism. And the world has to help the Israelis do this. The Israelis on their own are not going to suddenly say, oh, okay, we're going to, here's our border, we'll go back to the 67 border, we'll have security guarantees, we'll swap some lands, minimum settlements will be removed, the majority of settlers can stay where they are, and in return we swap lands. So the Israelis are not going to implement the very well-known parameters of a permanent and fair peace. They have to be pushed and cajoled and assisted militarily, financially, in security terms, and other ways to do this. And this is now missing. We don't have global leaders, very few around the world, who could do this. But this is a really critical requirement for the world to push on the Israelis and the Palestinians to move towards this kind of agreement. Because resolving the Palestine-Zionist conflict and the wider Arab-Israeli conflict is probably the single most important thing that could be done to bring about a peaceful, stable, productive, and joyful Middle East.
What does Samud mean in Arabic?
Samud means resistance, perseverance, steadfastness, all of these things together, that you hold your ground, you fight, you resist, you do what you can militarily, politically, economically. You send your kids to school, you plant some trees, you write some poetry, all the things that people do to carry on the actions that prove that they are normal human beings. The Palestinians are just ordinary, normal human beings. There's nothing special about them, other than that they've been subjected to the most draconian settler colonial violence of anybody in the region in the last 120 years or so. Anybody else would have fought back in the same way that they did. And we saw this in South Africa, we saw in Algeria, all in India, all over wherever colonialism happened, people held their ground as much as they could. And they suffered in big numbers. The Palestinians now have paid a huge price, 50, 60,000 dead in Gaza, probably 150,000 actually have died. The damage to human life and the structures of society is massive. But no colonial liberation has ever happened without people paying that kind of price, because the violence of the colonial settler occupiers is always the driving force. The colonial powers, whether it's Americans or British or French or Israeli, that they use to maintain their presence, to assert their superiority, to implement their racist apartheid type system. And the only way that you can confront that kind of violence is through military violence. People tried politically, you won't get anywhere. And of course, the American colonies tried it peacefully when they were starting out their life in the 1700s, and they tried to get the British crown to give them representation and taxation together. The British crown didn't. So the Americans took up arms and fought. This is human nature. It has nothing to do with who you are. The Jewish people in history did the same thing when they were subjugated by others. They tried to fight back, and they were defeated several times. And then by the Romans, finally, and evicted from the small Jewish community in Palestine was evicted. And for 2,000 years, they have thought about how do they come back. And then they did. Not all Jews in the world wanted to come back, but some did. And Jews all over the world thought of different ways in which they could exhibit sumud, of steadfastness, as Jewish people, as citizens of Western countries, as people who would come back and settle in Palestine and live as a minority among an Arab majority, which is what many of them did, that there was always a 5-7% minority of Jews in the Arab world. And the Jews finally, or some Jews, came up with the idea of Zionism, hooked it up with British colonial imperialism, and off they went. And here we are. So they've now become the aggressors and the genociders, and people are opposing them any way they can. And you see it defiantly in the U.S. in the student movement, and particularly in the young progressive Jews. And they're not all so young. You get, middle-aged people, especially women, in the Jewish Voice for Peace and many other movements like that. Jewish Americans are challenging what the U.S. government is doing and what Israel is doing. And students have followed suit. And it's extraordinary how American students have made the Gaza genocide a global moral issue, maybe the most powerful and pervasive issue of global moral concern around the entire world in the last year and a half. But of course, the world could not muster the necessary power to change Israeli policy or American, British policy, but they kept trying, and they'll keep trying. And this is why Samud is so important. The Israelis now are going to go on a rampage in the West Bank. And there's, Samud is the critical dynamic. You got to hold your ground, figure out how you can protect yourself, get other people to assist, get other people to constrain the Israeli racist attackers. Every contest has its own dynamics. But we see certain commonalities among them all.
The actual Gaza death toll, according to the respected British medical journal The Lancet, is undercounted by 40%. I mean, that's a staggering figure. You mentioned how many tens of thousands killed in Gaza. But let's focus a bit on the West Bank, since Gaza has, for good reason, had much of the media coverage, albeit what it is, how limited it is, almost 1,000 Palestinians have been killed in the West Bank since October 7th, not only by the Israeli military, but by settlers. Thousands more have been imprisoned, many without charge. The Israeli population of the settlements, the colonies, is more than 700,000. That includes East Jerusalem. The population of Israeli colonies in the Syrian Golan Heights is over 20,000. Very little reporting is done on this particular issue of settler colonialism.
The mainstream Western press has been conditioned through various techniques to not report on these aspects of Zionism and the state of Israel or American foreign policy, all three of which form a single unit. But this is also breaking down. There's two powerful forces that are at play, or two and a half. One is social media. There's all kinds of stuff on social media that gives anybody in the world who's interested a clear, direct, immediate, accurate view with video of what's happening. And you can hear the voices of the Palestinians. The second one is the progressive press in the United States. People like yourself, like Mondo Weiss, like Electronic Intifada, like there's a dozen major alternative media who really provide powerful, accurate information about the reality of both the actions of the Israelis and the supportive actions of the U.S. government. And the third one, the one I call half, is you're starting to see in the mainstream media, in NPR, in the New York Times, in other publications, you're starting to see reporting about the racist, apartheid, genocidal actions of the Israeli government and the link to American support. This is happening in small bits here and there, but it's starting to happen in a way that never happened before. This is an important sign. And of course, the mainstream media doesn't do this because they are so well-intentioned. They do this because they understand if they keep ignoring the realities of what the Israelis are doing with American support in perpetuating a genocide, they're going to lose readers, they're going to lose advertisers. And these are commercial entities. They have to get an audience to be able to sell dog food advertising to be able to make money. And if they start losing their audience, which is happening now, this is the one of the most important dynamics under the radar, that younger people in the United States under the age of, say, 40, 45, almost never read the mainstream media, the New York Times or Time Magazine or whatever, and more and more of them don't watch CNN and MSNBC and Fox and the cable networks, that they mostly get their news and views and analysis from the alternative media, from social media, and from personal contacts through their links with advocacy groups that are advocating for justice, which usually means advocating for Palestinian rights alongside Israeli rights. And this change is really one of the most, I think, important signs of the gradual change that I've been pointing out across different sectors of Western society, including the legal system, the political system, and the media and grassroots organizing. All of those things tend to happen together, and we're starting to see them. It took a century. It took a century for the Western mainstream media to start to understand that, well, there are these Palestinians whose land has been taken away from them, and we're starting to see better reporting a little bit in the mainstream media. The majority of mainstream media is not doing very good, but you're getting glimmers that never existed. And then the other two I mentioned, social media and alternative media, are expanding all the time. And by the way, why have the Israelis essentially failed to achieve their three major goals in Gaza related to Hamas? To wipe them out, to make sure that they make no further security threats to Israel, and that they have no role in the future governance of Palestine. That's all three of those things the Israelis have failed. This is important for people to understand.
Thanks very much for your time.
Thank you for having me.
You were just listening to Rami Khoury, War or Peace in the Middle East. This program is produced by Alternative Radio. We're an independent nonprofit in our 39th year. We're supported solely by individuals just like you. We feature such voices as Ilan Pape, Ralph Nader, Peter Beinert, Francesca Albanese, and Chris Hedges. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. For copies of today's program, Rami Khoury, War or Peace in the Middle East, and for Rashid Khalidi's classic book, The 100 Years' War on Palestine, call us 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-444-1977. Or online, our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org. Printed transcripts, PDFs, and MP3s of this program are free of charge. Just call us, 1-800-444-1977. Special thanks to KGNU. Joe Ritchie is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamian. Thank you for listening. We go out with Mohammed Youssef singing in Arabic, Mawtani, my homeland.
موطني موطني الجمال والجلال والسناء والبهاء في رباك في رباك والحياة والنجاة والهناء والرجاء في هواك.